The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome to another edition of the Russian Orthodox Medievalist. Today, we're going to be dealing with an issue of tremendous importance for those people who are interested in the political theory and ideas of ethnic nationalism. And what we're going to deal with is really the collapse of Ukrainian independence under the pressure of the Bolshevik invasion at the end of World War I. And we're going to start in the 1870s. You know, Ukraine, we have a situation where we have a Ukrainian state. We have people who accept the idea of a Ukrainian, an Orthodox identity, without much of a chance of actually building a independent Ukrainian state. This is a substantial object lesson for those of us who are concerned with questions of multipolarity, with the questions of nationalism and true ethnic sovereignty in an age of globalization, of forced globalization. So, there are a few points to be made, first of all. In the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s in Ukraine, there is an increasing impoverishment of the Ukrainian peasantry. There is a certain degree of land hunger. There is substantial population growth. While at the same time, there is also rapid urban industrial development. This is a major issue. But even more important than that, the nature of this urbanization and this kind of development is, basically, from the point of view of a Jewish, Russian, and German urban population. Very few actual Ukrainians live in the cities. And so you have what starts off as a trickle, but then becomes a substantial avalanche of Ukrainian moves to the cities in the 1880s. The peasantry itself remains to some extent illiterate. And this is going to show up later in Stalin's era, where you have substantial labor shortages in Ukraine, partially because of the lack of skilled labor. But World War I comes in to develop sort of a national jumping-off point of substantial, not only urbanization, industrialization, but also a much, much stronger sense of national consciousness. So what's happening here is nationalism is something that exists only in the countryside. It's often said that nationalism develops only in urban centers because of industrialization and this need for a standard national way of living to coordinate all of these things. But here in Ukraine in the 1870s, that theory is proven false. The fact is that nationalism develops and is strongest primarily in the countryside. And there it will remain. And one of the more attractive elements of the Ukrainian national idea is, number one, it is socialist, it is communitarian, but is also strictly agrarian. And so a very strong communitarian sense of an ethnic Ukrainian identity will develop. It will develop strongly around the turn of the century, given the pressures of the coming war, and of this real problem, a relatively unique problem, where Ukraine's urban centers are, in fact, not Ukrainian, and in some cases, openly hostile to things that are Ukrainian. So, the war will ravage the country. The war will impoverish the country. But World War One will see in 1917 the development of really one of the first nationalist institutions. I mean, one of the first nationalist institutions since the Cossack host, the Ukrainian Central Rada. The Rada is simply another name for a for a parliament, for an elected legislature, which by 1917 comes into existence. It is made up overwhelmingly of basically liberal nationalist intellectuals, and they claim to represent all of Ukraine. And this is the problem, because they clearly do not. For the most part, the intellectuals who run the Rada are somewhat isolated from the population. They derive some of the few Ukrainians actually living in the urban areas. For the most part, the party structure is, to some extent, Ukrainian nationalist. There are some social revolutionaries and social democrats making up the far left of the Rada, but these are non-communist leftist movements. These are generally not socialist, but they do advocate some kind of socialization of the land, because that which is Ukrainian is that which is agrarian. This is the concept of the Rada. The only problem is the makeup of the Rada and the parties of the Rada are from people who are, in essence, urban. Now, what's happening is, as the war progresses, Ukrainian industry takes off. And you'll find, and this is very significant for Russian development, that it is the far west in the Russian world, Ukraine, Belarus, etc., that is the most industrialized, and that is the most advanced in terms of economics. But it is going to be exactly these parts of Russia that are given to the Germans at the Treaty of Brest. And this is something that's going to make Lenin very unpopular. But Western Ukraine will eventually come under German domination, but as the war is raging, it is the demands of warfare that are industrializing the country, but they're also bringing Ukrainian-speaking peasants into the city. That means Ukrainian urban life slowly but surely is becoming more and more Ukrainian, and you have a proletarian generation developing in the major cities. In the far east, of course, Kharkiv, in the center, Kiev, and in the west, Lvov. These are the big three, and there's many others, but those are the big three that are becoming more and more Ukrainian as former peasants are now becoming workers. As far as the Rada is concerned, the actual Ukrainian nationalist parties did very poorly in the cities. The cities were not Ukrainian, and this is an absolutely central point. The Rada ends up being a moderate socialist institution that actually comes to satisfy absolutely nobody. This is the great weakness. It ends up being kind of a ordinary left-liberal institution with some nationalist leanings that on the one hand do not satisfy peasant demands for land and a greater income from their production. It does not satisfy your more right-wing nationalists who are looking for a more unitary society based on some kind of ethnic socialist ideal. And both sides will attack this institution and eventually be at least its internal cause for its downfall. The other thing is that they lacked the trained personnel necessary for serious state and nation building. I'm not much of a fan of the state as it developed in the West. But given the nature of Ukrainian society, and given the nature of the fact that Ukraine was surrounded by people on every direction not interested in Ukrainian independence, the nature of a strong state is absolutely essential. The state is essential here, regardless of everything else. You have no Ukrainian state tradition, but you have a strong Ukrainian religious, political, and social tradition. State building becomes a major problem in Ukrainian life, and the fact is that even if there was some kind of an agreement as to what would constitute a legitimate Ukrainian state, by the way, a problem still has not been solved, even as of this broadcast, 2009, that has not been solved. But even if there was one, there in Ukraine, there is not the trained personnel to staff it. So the primary question, though, in spite of all of these problems, the Rada will break down between 1917 and early 1918 based on the fact that they cannot agree on the issues of landholding. Landholding becomes an essential question. Should it be individual? Should it be communal? Should private property and land be acceptable? And if so, how much can one person hold? What do we do about the possibility of a landless proletariat? All of these questions had been huge in Russia in the 1860s. They are now developing in Ukraine with no satisfactory response. Given the fact that the membership of the Rada did not represent the countryside to any great extent, there was no real action. There was no real understanding concerning the nature of the peasant problem. Now, 1918, the Civil War has begun in Russia. By now, the Tsar Nicholas II has been officially deposed and executed, and the civil war has broken out between, in my view, are two very bad options: a highly oligarchic, ideological and apolitical white army, which is certainly not royalist in its makeup. And, of course, a far more unified and yet better funded, specifically from Western sources, Red Army led by Leon Trotsky. Just as an aside, it's been my view for a long time that it's not merely foreign funding that guaranteed the Red Army a victory in the war. I think the main cause, if I have to pick a single cause as to why Trotsky was able to pull this off, between 1918 and 1921, it's largely because the Red Army was the only military formation of any power in Russian and Ukrainian space that actually had an agenda. The Whites never put out a political program. Trotsky did. I don't think that the Bolsheviks actually meant it, since the program was very simply an end of World War One, or at least of Russia's involvement in World War One. Peace at home and abroad, and food for the peasants, land for the peasants. Of course, they didn't believe in private property, so that had to have been a tongue-in-cheek demand. None of these promises were ever fulfilled in the Red Army, but the very fact that they put out a very simple and easy-to-grasp program is one of the major issues that permitted the White Army to lose, the Red Army to win. But that exact same problem is going to occur here again. In 1918, the Bolshevik Red Army will invade Ukraine. As soon as news reaches the capital, the Rada will declare full independence from Russia and declare itself dependent on nobody. Not too long after the Bolshevik invasion, the Germans will invade Ukraine from the northwest, and they will drive the Bolsheviks out. So as far as particularly Western Ukraine is concerned, Ukraine is going to be squeezed between two powers for a short time. That will increase, and in fact Ukraine will be squeezed by many powers as that year 1918 continues. But at first, the Bolsheviks invade from the east, to some extent from the north. The Germans will also invade from the north and from the west. The Bolsheviks will be defeated by the Germans, but this is going to be a pattern in German relations with Ukraine. They refuse to attempt to make friends with the Ukrainian population. Instead, they will do exactly what Hitler will do later on, make the huge mistake of making enemies where they could have made friends. The German army, the German government at home is very unstable. Germany has lost a huge amount of men. This is at the very end of the war. But they are still more experienced and better armed than the Bolsheviks. Certainly, the Rada really doesn't have any substantial military force that's loyal to it. But so the Germans will have no difficulty in taking most of Ukraine, driving the Bolsheviks out, but then engaging in the sin of grain requisitioning. The Red Army was also doing this, by the way, and grain requisitioning is the practice of an invading army taking the produce from the peasants with the purpose of feeding that army without recompense, or at most, promises of recompense, of course, promises that never develop. At this time, there is a Cossack leader by the name of Petro Skoropadze, a very controversial figure. He is a self-appointed head of the Ukrainian Cossack host. He will take over from the failed Rada in a Cossack coup d'etat and declare himself pro-German. Now, Skoropadze is a figure that is often dismissed by Ukrainian historians. He is often dismissed by Russian historians. He is not taken very seriously. And in fact, at least in the English language, there's not a whole lot out there on him. Skoropadze is a very conservative man. He is generally supportive of the white forces. He is supportive of the concept of an independent Ukraine under some kind of German tutelage. That's a relatively realistic concept given the situation in Ukraine at the time, and the fact that open, complete independence is simply an impossibility. Skoropadze will attempt to create an independent Ukraine with the assistance of the Cossack host on the one hand and the German forces on the other. And I want to stress that Skoropadze did not speak for all the Cossacks. He probably spoke only for a small percentage of them. But it is a realistic approach to Ukrainian independence in 1918. We will continue this when we come back. Ukrainian independence, 1920.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Between 1918 and 1920, Ukraine will be attacked and under assault from any number of forces. At the end of World War I and the reconstitution of the Polish state, which had not been in existence since the reign of Catherine the Great in Russia, the Poles in 1920 will invade Ukraine from the west. At the same time, the white armies, which only roughly have another year to go, will also invade and set up shop in the Crimea. There is also a strong anarchist movement under a man named Nestor Makhno, a man who should be taken seriously, a man who was relatively popular in much of Ukraine. He was an agrarian anarchist, and he had his own militia that was both violently anti-communist and violently anti-white. Now, for that reason alone, Makhno is a relatively sympathetic figure. Making matters more complicated, you also have the Allied invasion of Russia, largely from the north, but there's also a French mission in the Crimea. So Ukraine, between 1918, has been attacked by Imperial Germany, has been attacked by the Bolsheviks, has been attacked by the White Forces, has been attacked by the anarchist militia, has been attacked by the Allied forces, and then again attacked by the Bolsheviks. So Ukraine is in desperate state, in a desperate condition, desperate straits by 1920, 1921. She is in big trouble. The Poles and the Whites make themselves probably the least popular of all the groups that will attack Ukraine in this period of time. The Poles, because they make it very clear that this is a revenge attack for the Austrian support of certain Ukrainian demands in the late 19th century, where the Polish crown, the Austrian crown in Vienna, would use the Ukrainians to fight against Polish interests throughout the national agitation of the 19th and very early 20th century. And really, the Polish invasion is a nasty and bloody affair because the Poles are, they're engaging in revenge killings for Ukrainian uprisings centuries earlier. The fact is that there's never been any love lost, not just between Poles and Russians, but also Poles and Ukrainians. The Ukrainians, of course, complained that the Poles were their imperial overlords for centuries and centuries, which is also the case. So the Polish invasion, which will eventually be defeated by the Bolsheviks, and actually might be one of the reasons that the Bolsheviks will finally defeat all comers in Ukraine, because in defeating the Poles, they make themselves relatively popular. I also want to disabuse you of any myths about the Allied intervention in Russia in 1919-1920. These were not anti-communist movements, not by any stretch of the imagination. They fought in favor of the Reds as much as they fought in favor of the Whites. The only real demand that the Allied intervention in Russia had was that Russia maintain the Eastern Front during the war. That was the main purpose. And this was the function of the Allied intervention starting in 1918. And the idea of making the world safe for American capital was absolutely essential. After a while, it'll be clear that the Allies will support the Bolsheviks, but only in so much as the Bolsheviks drop their claim to demanding peace on the Eastern Front. When peace is finally made by the Bolsheviks, it will be immensely unpopular since most of Western Russia is given away to the Germans. And then it is given away to the Poles when they're reconstituted in 1918-1919. So the Allies continue, not to mention the fact that you have a substantial German force that remains in Ukraine even after the war is over. So there is still this idea that the Allies are not satisfied with the outcome of World War I, even as late as 1920. So, the collapse of Ukrainian independence. Not only are the Whites incapable of developing a sense of what Ukraine is supposed to be, they do not. In fact, the Whites make it very clear that they reject any concept of Ukrainian independence. And here you have another example of anti-communists doing almost everything in their power to alienate the anti-communist government in Ukraine. The Whites will also engage in very obnoxious grain requisitioning. And so by the time 1921, 1922 comes around, the peasants simply view the anti-communist forces as those people, whether they be German, whether they be Russian, whether they be Polish, come in and take all of our grain and our cattle. So the anti-communist forces were not defeated by the Red Army. They killed themselves. That is very, very clear. Their behavior was obnoxious. Their behavior was oligarchic. They did not care. They did everything they could, both Germany and the white forces, to alienate the Ukrainian population. Hitler will do the exact same thing in 1940 when he sends the SS in to begin cleansing some of the Slavic elements in the Ukrainian population, again doing everything in his power to alienate the Ukrainian nationalist movement. By 1921, the Red Army had taken all of Ukraine. And again, the problem is that the Bolshevik forces are either of Russian or of Jewish background, and as a result, strictly urban, because that was the basic makeup of the urban population. It was very Jewish, very Russian, living uneasily side by side with a very small Polish and German minority. Given the fact that by 1921 there was no more will to fight, the war had given no benefits to the average Ukrainian person. The war had given no benefits even to the average Ukrainian elite. The government of Skoropadze did not last long because he did not survive the eventual withdrawal of the German forces. The whites didn't believe in independent Ukraine, so there was no white government in Ukraine. They made it clear that they were going to suppress Ukrainian nationalism, guaranteeing that the Bolsheviks were going to win in that area. The anarchists were not, and that would have been an interesting experiment had Nestor Makhno at least carved out a substantial part of Ukraine for himself, but he was not organized well enough, and the Allies didn't arm him because they didn't see any benefit in arming the anarchist movement. The Bolsheviks certainly didn't see it. The Germans didn't see it. So Nestor Makhno, who I think was a relatively virtuous man, had no support. I mean, if anything, the anarchists were the only honest group in this battle, because they were completely dependent on their own resources and their own ability to speak intelligently to the peasants. And I think it's possible that the anarchists would have done better had Nestor Makhno not taken this kind of anarchist dogma that religion is evil. In fact, the sort of orthodoxy that was developing in Ukraine was highly democratic, highly communitarian, and I have an article floating around out there on the whole Ukrainian concept of soborno pravanya, which is an essentially Christian anarchist and democratic approach to church building, strictly within the doctrinal confines of the Orthodox world. Had he understood this, had he grasped this, I think the situation by 1921 in Ukraine would have been much different. The fact is that even though Makhno, I think, was moral and intelligent, Nestor Makhno did not speak the language of the Ukrainian peasant, which was socialist, anarchist, and yet highly religious. He had two of those ingredients. He didn't have all three. So, we come back, we will talk about the collapse of Ukraine and what happened and what we could learn from this.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
So, the collapse of Ukraine, 1920-1922. I can't stress enough the fact that any of these movements that seek to take power have to have a solid, rational argument platform that's simple, speaking the language of the average person. The RADA couldn't do this. The whites couldn't do this. The Germans and Skoropadzi did not do this. There was only two forces in Ukrainian life in this era that had a strong and relatively popular program, and that is Nestor Makhno and the anarchists on the one hand and the Bolsheviks on the other. The Bolsheviks had no intention of keeping those promises, since they promised land to the peasantry, even though they didn't believe in private property. The concept of collectivization was going to come later. But nevertheless, even that's unimportant, particularly with a population that is exhausted from fighting, that has seen millions of its sons killed, and that its farms have been ravaged by all of these invading armies, stealing food to maintain their supplies. So the development of Bolshevism in Ukraine comes from the fact that, number one, Bolshevism was the best funded and best organized movement in Ukraine, and number two, had a strong, simple, popular approach to government. Peace, land, and bread. That was the slogan that spoke to the heart of the Ukrainian peasant. The Ukrainian Rada, as we said before, was also incapable of developing a solid agenda. They were too divided and they were too isolated. 1920-1921, a new Rada will be developed under Soviet control. It would be in the far east of the country, in Kharkiv, where Khrushchev is born. And they declare formally the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. Now, that Kharkivan Republic had actually been in existence since 1918. That's the republic in eastern Ukraine that had been swept away by the Germans. But by the early 1920s, that threat no longer existed. The Bolsheviks, as well as the whites, had destroyed the Poles. The anarchists were in a state of decay. The Bolsheviks will then eventually set up shop in Kiev and then redeclare the Soviet Socialist Republic of Ukraine, the UKSSR. Now, Ukrainians sought, realizing that there was no option. The Bolsheviks, at the time, the Bolsheviks, given their organization, given their funding, particularly from Western sources, given the ridiculous policies and failures of the whites as well as the Rada forces, the Bolsheviks sensed that they had earned this victory. Their opponents did as much to kill themselves as to be eliminated by the Red Army forces. So there was a native, urban, relatively small, but yet very important group in Ukraine called the Kievan Movement. The Kievan Movement was a group of national communists. The concept of national communism is going to be a regular feature in Soviet politics from this moment on. Ultimately, both Lenin and Stalin will condemn the concept of national communism, and it will be, with some exceptions, such as Georgia and Armenia, maybe some of the Islamic republics, for the most part will be banished from Russian and Ukrainian communist circles. The Ukrainian nationalists, having been defeated on every conceivable front, make one last ditch effort. Those who remain in the country, many go into exile. The Ukrainian nationalist movement, with its own militia, that had developed in the 1920s, they will also go into exile. We will deal with them some other time. But, the Kievan movement represent a certain kind of National Socialism that looked to Moscow for protection. This national communism, the national Bolshevik movement in Ukraine, will seek a Ukrainian-speaking, Ukrainian cultural communism based not on urbanization and industry, but on the agrarian life. This, you know, you can interpret this any number of ways. I mean, this could be a way to finally speak the language of the peasant, to talk about what good could come of a unified Slavic market under Moscow's protection, which will finally end all of these wars and maintain not the Bolshevism that wanted to collectivize all property, but the sort of Bolshevism that created some kind of agrarian socialism where the peasants can keep their land. This is what the Kievan movement was all about. But it needs to be made clear that not only did the whites reject Ukrainian independence, so did the Reds. The difference between the two of them was that the Reds didn't talk about that very much. In fact, they would use the concept of Ukrainian independence, especially when fighting against the whites and the Poles. And they would put out leaflets saying that if the whites won, they were going to reinstitute serfdom and take all of your land, and you're going to become a part of the United States, and you're going to be enslaved and everything else. We, the Reds, are fighting for a true and free Ukraine. They said the same things about the Poles. The Poles take over, they're going to reinstitute serfdom, and you're all going to be slaves again, and you're all going to have to be Roman Catholics. And, you know, that was the nature of the you know, peasant-oriented propaganda of the time. But only when, only by 1921, by the time of the first Congress of the Ukrainian Communist Party in the early 20s, when all opposition had largely faded away, then they show their true face. For the first time, the first Congress of the Ukrainian Communist Party, controlled by Moscow and imposed by the Red Army, will show its true agenda. It will openly and formally reject the principle of national communism. The leader of the Kievan movement and the national communist is Mykola Skirtnik. And by the end of the 1920s, he will become one of Stalin's major enemies. And, you know, once the Bolsheviks had made clear that there will not be an independent Ukraine, that there will not be private property, and that your churches will not be allowed to function anymore, the only thing that was left were the national communists led by Skerepnik that wanted a Bolshevism, but a Bolshevism with purely Ukrainian characteristics. Ultimately, what happens is the condemnation of national communism, the Kievan movement will be liquidated by Stalin, but not before Lenin, as a way to mollify this group, will permit an all-Ukrainian Ministry of Agriculture, Justice, Health, and Education. Those were the four ministries in Kiev that Lenin permitted to be run by Ukrainians for a Ukrainian audience. But these were paper provisions, because the fact is, they may have had Ukrainian last names. They were dictated to from Lenin and from Moscow. Stalin, of course, will eventually liquidate this entire movement and collectivize property. Lenin was somebody, I don't think he disagreed with Stalin about this. He was just a better politician than Stalin was. Lenin approached the Ukrainian problem by attacking Russian chauvinism rather than by promoting the concept of Ukrainian nationalism. But, you know, by the mid-20s, that was all that any Ukrainian nationalist that was alive and functioning in urban Ukraine at that time could ever really hope for. There was an underground movement, but for the most part, the Ukrainians, the church, had gone into exile and supported their own institutions, rejecting the concept of any possible alliance with the whites, because the whites had made it clear that the Ukrainians were just ignorant hicks that had no right to their own state. Okay, but later on, we're talking 1930s now, by the time of the 10th Ukrainian Communist Congress, there is some sense that some of the ethnic issues need to be taken more seriously. The Bolsheviks never, although they forced themselves on the countryside, they never were accepted by the common population. There's no way to really tell the distinction in terms of peasant attitudes at that time. There's simply no way to know. It's probably clear that they were anti-German, that they were anti-white, they were definitely anti-Polish. They may have had some sympathy with Machno, but unfortunately Machno wasn't religious enough to build a real mass-based movement there. The Bolsheviks were the only game in town, but it didn't mean that the average peasant supported what Lenin will eventually call war communism, which simply imitates the behavior of the white armies. But at least Lenin promises and Trotsky promises that it will be only temporary. But by the 1930s, it's clear that the Bolsheviks have not taken root in the countryside.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
The Bolsheviks make themselves unpopular in the countryside. There are several movements by the time Stalin is ensconced in power. There are several things that Stalin has in mind here. Stalin, remember, was the Minister of Nationalities under Lenin. That is to say, Stalin was the head of the department that dealt with these ethnic issues. Stalin held several issues, sometimes contradictory, at the same time. The main issue, and we'll talk about Stalin more specifically at some other time, but for now, Stalin's main issue is linking the idea of the village kulak with nationalism. The kulak is a Russian word that has a lot of meanings. The main meaning is fist. Both fist in terms of a weapon, but fist in terms of describing people who were very greedy and tight-fisted. The kulaks were, they never had a firm definition. The formal definition was a peasant that can hire another peasant to work for him for a few months out of the year. That was the formal Communist Party definition. But in actual practice, it had no definition. A kulak was any rebellious farmer, whether in the Russian or in the Ukrainian countryside. Stalin wants to stamp out any vestige of national communism from Ukraine, and as a result of this, he will attempt to link Ukrainian national inspiration, Ukrainian national aspiration from the inspiration of the kulaki, the people who are considered wealthy peasants by the Communist Party. Of course, in practice, anybody who opposed collectivization was automatically called a kulak, no matter how poor they may be, and sent off to the camps. Stalin began to appoint local party members who rejected Ukrainianization, and one of the ways of doing this was to make sure that the Jews from the urban centers of Ukraine got the plum positions throughout the Ukrainian countryside. But at the time, you know, national communism, another name for national communism, was Borodbisism, that this continued to have some kind of resonance in the countryside. Even as early as 1923, as Lenin was really near the end of his life, there was an official promotion of Ukrainianization. Nothing really ever happened. The fact is that none of Lenin's promises were ever carried out. That chances are, even though Lenin had some token interest in Ukrainianization, he didn't trust, and neither did Stalin, trust any real Ukrainian, particularly Ukrainians in the countryside. The strength of the Communist Party in Ukraine was almost exclusively Jewish, exclusively urban, with a strong smattering of Russian ethnic interests in the urban areas. That's the fact of the matter. That movement, that column in Ukrainian life took over and ran the country right up until, who knows, maybe right up until the present day, with the way that the Ukrainian oligarchs behave, their strong urban and Jewish background. And the fact is that the violence of the genocide in the 1930s was made more violent because of Stalin's interest in promoting Jewish anti-agrarian forces to positions of power in the countryside, where they had no problem liquidating the Ukrainian peasant and destroying Ukrainian infrastructure in the interest of Jewish supremacy and the Russian Communist Party. That's simply the fact of the matter, and that's the nature of both Lenin and Stalin's rule. So, to conclude all of this, we're talking about a bunch of issues in terms of nationalism and its relationship to socialism, which is kind of a big deal for me and this program. But there is, we have this problem. Those of us who are both nationalist and agrarian in our approach to the world, you see by 1900 and by the beginning of World War I, 1914 and 1915, we see a rapid disintegration of the traditional way of life in the Ukrainian countryside. You see a substantial industrialization occurring in eastern Ukraine, in Kharkiv, and elsewhere in eastern Ukraine, which will become the urban center of the Ukrainian Communist Party. And as I said, it's now infamous for being the birthplace of Khrushchev, who kind of made a big deal out of the fact that he came from really the party headquarters in Ukraine, which was in Kharkiv, which was heavily Jewish, heavily urban, heavily industrial, and quite frankly, almost completely non-Ukrainian. So you develop this concept of an eastern Ukraine, which had been colonized by the communist urban interest, and the rural life of western Ukraine. And, you know, the main reason that the Rada could not function is that a true nationalist discourse in Ukraine between 1918 and 1930 had to be linked to the land question. You could talk about national independence all you want, but unless you linked that with peasant demands, legitimate peasant demands for more land, better land, land that they could control without fear of coming under attack from the whites or the Poles or the Bolsheviks or whoever else, Godopadzi, Germans, any number of others, those two things had to be linked. Those peasant demands had to be linked with the nationalist movement. The Rada never did that, the white forces never did that, and so, quite frankly, they deserve to lose. It's unfortunate for Ukraine, but they dug their own grave. No one in the countryside really believed that the Rada was legitimate. It wasn't legitimate because they didn't make that linkage. A nationalism without some kind of agrarian socialism, where families, extended families, communes, and even individuals are guaranteed their land, that there are no wealthy who dominate them and exploit them. And, that is really at the root of this kind of a real national solidarity. The Rada never made that connection. And in many ways, members of the Rada were the same people who exploited them at home. They also didn't have the ability to communicate. They didn't speak the language of the peasants. They didn't have that background. They didn't have that ability, and they didn't have the trained staff to make it work. And in general, the urban areas from the Rada period all the way up, really even into the present day, looked at the Ukrainians in a very, very biased and very prejudiced way. your classic Jewish and Russian urban view of the Ukrainian peasant was that he is ignorant, and you know, he's okay when he's shining my shoes and growing my food, but otherwise he needs to shut up. And the fact is that the only real legitimate source of, I shouldn't say legitimate in a moral sense, but the only stable government that the Ukrainians ever had was that imposed by Bolsheviks, the Red Army, Trotsky, and Lenin. And that's the real nature of the Russian victory there. And so a rebuilding of a nationalist Ukraine, an Orthodox Ukraine, along national, ethnic, religious, socialist, and even anarchist lines, federalist lines, needs to take all of this into consideration. So I want to thank the Voice of Reason, Mike and Steve and Dietrich and everyone else who's helped me here. I appreciate everything you've done for me. I appreciate my listeners. Any of you can email me. My email address is on the VOR site. I appreciate it. I thank you very much, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Ariad.